and welcome to this special Mother's Day edition of the podcast of moralapologetics.com. I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. On this week's podcast, we sit down with Dr. David Baggett for his thoughts on the importance of mothers to morality. Dr. Baggett shares how his own mother shaped his character and how God can heal those who've lost their mothers or who had mothers that maybe let them down, and how mothers reveal the love of God. And at the end, we have the real special privilege to hear Dr. David Baggett share the eulogy he gave for his own mother. So I encourage you to stay tuned and listen to that. One more note before we get to the podcast. Dr. Baggett and I, we recorded this at the IHOP over here in Lynchburg. So throughout the discussion, you'll hear the kitchen door opening and closing and dishes banging around. With that in mind, we'll head on over to the IHOP and hear what Dr. Baggett has to say. So, Dr. Baggett, you have a mom, right?
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Appreciate it.
So be very careful.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Every human being has a mother, but not every human being has the same mother.
Well, are philosophers really human? So, you know, that might be a question some people have.
That's funny. Yep. Even Al Plantinga had a mother.
Well, you know, tomorrow is Mother's Day, and interestingly enough, there's a lot of overlap with moms and morality, you might say, in a lot of different ways. I think it'd be a good idea to maybe talk about that a little bit and explore that some, maybe even talk a little bit about our personal relationship to moms.
Yeah. You know? Well, you should tell me about your mother.
Okay. Well, I have a mom like most people. You know, one of the things I think that's difficult to do is to say exactly what your mom has done for you because you're so close to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you kind of have to get a little distance to be able to see it.
I suspect that's true. It takes something to give you perspective, right? Yeah, because the influence of your parents on you, you know, can be so pervasive and all-encompassing and ubiquitous that you don't even really begin to be able to recognize, you know, how significant it is. Yeah, I lost my mom a few years ago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very difficult experience, and I suppose that offered me some of that perspective that you were speaking of there. You know, because when she died, it gave me the chance to really come to terms with what a hole her departure would leave in my life. And I had lost my dad already, so when I lost my mom, at that point I had lost both my parents, and there's this kind of interesting phenomenon Jim Nutter and I were talking about it just recently, that when you lose that second parent, you're left feeling a bit unmoored in the world, you know.
Yeah.
The two people from whom you came are gone. And it feels a bit odd, you know.
And that's, I mean, I tried to think about how my mother has influenced me, and I can see some things, but some things are so essential that I feel like I can't really stand outside myself enough to see.
Yeah, right.
And then maybe once I get older, I can see better. I'm certainly thankful for what I already have said, you know.
Sure.
And of course, you know, the fact that my mom is a Christian and she cares. I mean, it's, you know, it's, 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 I can't imagine how significant it is to grow up in a household where it's normal to care about people, it's normal to pray, it's normal to go to church. I mean, that alone is got to be just life-saving in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah. You know, and if the psychologists are right, and I have no doubt that they are, some of those earliest years of our lives, you know, are among the most formative. And so some of the lessons that we, you know, pick up almost by osmosis from an extremely young age can shape our moral perspectives for decades, you know, for much of our lives. So those early years, you know, are just so vitally important to what our mother and father do, how they treat us, how they make us look at the world, and what they do to shape our views of others and ourselves. So very important. And I think that, not to psychologize people, but I mean, I think it's undoubtedly true that those who grow up without a loving mother or a loving father have a much more difficult time coming to believe in a God who is altogether loving. So oftentimes I think that the biggest obstacle standing in people's way to believing in a truly good God is that their parents simply didn't love them as they ought, you know, didn't treat them as they should have, and that makes it more difficult. I don't think it's a beyond redemption,
right,
or anything like that. You know, God can break through, but I tell you, it's a real grace to be raised with loving parents.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there's this idea about well, I think it's in scripture, and it's in guys like Aristotle, and about the formation of character, right? That your character is like the way your soul is, you might say, and that this can be shaped for good or for ill, and this is part of moral transformation is developing the character of Christ. And it's really interesting to me how, you know, I think a lot of mothers out there don't see the good they're doing by simply just being attentive and loving to their kids. I mean, they create a context where the soul can grow up in a healthy way. Like that child's soul is formed in a way that makes it so that when they don't have these dysfunctions, right, that they don't have the disfiguring of the soul that can be so hard to overcome.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's true. And those parents who are doing their job well and right are really contributing so much to the world, you know, by giving these kids a healthy perspective and self-esteem and you know, view of reality and understanding of how to live in this world, navigate their way through it, treat other people. It's the most important job in the world. And interestingly enough, you don't have to pass any real test to get the job.
Right. Yeah.
And some people get the job, and they really shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
And others, you know, just do the job so faithfully and so well. Every parent, every mother makes mistakes, of course. There's no such thing as the perfect mother. But there are many, many great mothers out there.
Yeah. What did you, could you tell us about your mother a little bit there, Dr. Baggett?
Yep, I can do that. I was real close with my mom, and I really found her to be very delightful. At times, of course, she could be exasperating as anyone. Because she had her stubborn streaks and such. But I really deeply cared for her. She was a wonderful person. She had a very rough upbringing of her own. She grew up in a family in which her My father was an alcoholic. And she told me that in later years, you know, looking back, she didn't really remember many happy days as a girl. Oftentimes, in fact, her father would get home, and he would be drunk, and she would hide. And this happened day in and day out for years. And I think she was about 16 when he finally told her simply to, you know, to get out of the house. And with hardly any money in her pocket and the clothes on her back and some bus tickets, she left the house and never went back. She was in Detroit at the time, and she was able to secure an apartment on promise of paying rent when she got paid. And kind of just slowly built her life from there. And she worked as a biller and so forth. And some years later, you know, not too long, you know, she would meet my dad. And after he got back from Korea, you know, they'd get married. And she was a stay-at-home mom. She raised six kids. I was the last of the six. She was always there when I'd come home from school. You know, she was always there to bandage the knee, give me the pep talk. She always believed in me. She'd always encourage me. She'd always tell me that I could do anything I set my mind to. And she'd always tell me to try everything once, which I don't think is a good piece of advice, but took it with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
In later years after my dad died, she and I grew even closer, and we took some trips to England together, and she even went with me to three Wheaton conferences, you know, philosophy conferences at Wheaton College. And she was such a fun person. She'd go and she would attend the talks. And so she had no training at all in philosophy. She would always tell me that she was the theologian and I was the philosopher. So she listened to these talks at the Wheaton conference. And I remember one year, some of the speakers were really high-powered guys like Foley and Volderstorff and such. And there were a few papers that I was really struggling to follow and understand. And on one occasion in particular, I walked out thinking, I don't know if I understood about 10% of that. And I said, so what did you think about that? And she said, well, I followed every bit of it. I understood everything that was said. And I was thinking, wow, that's pretty impressive. I can't help but think that's not true. The first time she went to a philosophy conference, she was befuddled, though, because she said, well, the first guy got up there and he preached. She characterized it as preaching. It was a conference, but he preached, and I agreed with everything that he said. And then that other guy got up, and it was, you know, by way of a response to the first, right? And she goes, and he preached against everything that the first guy preached, and then I didn't know what to believe. And one funny story pertaining to the Wheaton conferences. We were coming back one year from there, and I wanted to stop at Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana, and it was pretty much on the way from Chicago back to Detroit. And so she agreed, and it was a Saturday, so we happened to pull in just as a football game was letting out. So I said, I want to go off and explore the campus and see Touchdown Jesus and the Golden Dome and whatnot, you know. I said, do you want to come? And she said, no, I'll just hang out around here, you know, near the car. So I went off and explored and came back about 20 minutes later, thereabouts. And she was sitting there in the car with a big plate full of food. And I said, where did you get that? You know, my goodness. And she said, oh, well, you know, I went over there, and she pointed to a tailgate party. She goes, I went over there to that little stand, and I ordered food. She thought it was just a concession stand out of someone's car. And she said, and they were so nice. They gave me all this food. They gave me this plate and put all this food on it. And I said, do you have a hot dog? And they said, well, you know, we don't have a hot dog, but if you come back next week, we'll have a hot dog for you. She said, but anyway, then I got out my purse to pay them, you know, for all this food. And they said, we don't want your money. You know, you just come back next week. We'll have that hot dog for you. And then she said, but I don't understand. They were so nice, but how can they make it as a business if they don't charge anyone? So that's the story of my mom crashing a tailgate party at Notre Dame.
Well, I mean, what would she think about you being a philosopher? I mean, I guess she knew you were a philosopher, right? What did she think about that?
Yeah. Well, you know, she had a great sense of humor, so she would say things like, you know, you're the kind of doctor who can't help anybody, you know, you're a philosopher, and nobody can tell me what philosophy is. You ask everybody what philosophy is, you get a different answer from everybody. When I was in college and I first decided to major in philosophy, she was so funny because she could never remember it. And so whenever she would go to tell somebody what my major was, she said, oh, yeah, he's studying psychology? Is it psychology? She could never remember. Yeah. Philosophy, Mom. But a lot of that was just her way of making light of situations. You know, in truth, she was the most affirming person of anyone I knew. And she was always, you know, very proud if I could, you know, pass a class or write a paper or get published or whatever else. She was just an unstinting source of encouragement and advice, sometimes solicited, sometimes not. Encouragement, affirmation. So she was a wonderful person, and when she died, it was very difficult, you know, to come to terms with that, to come to terms with the idea of this world without her, you know. And I'm very much looking forward to seeing her again.
Well, you know, one thought I had while you're talking about her is, you know, considering where she came from and what she became, you know, the kind of transformation that she had in her own life, how do you think she was able to do that?
Yeah. I really think that was a testimony to the power of God at work within her life. She was raised in the Lutheran tradition. My dad was raised in the Presbyterian tradition. But in neither of their lives did it really take root until after they got together, and they went to an evangelistic crusade of some sort. Mm-hmm. And they both went to the altar, you know, and they committed their lives to God and committed themselves to raising their kids in church. And so I grew up, you know, in a Christian home. By the time I came along, you know, they were committed Christians, regular church members, and in fact, every summer we'd go to church camp, too, on top of that, you know, which is like, you know, intense church on steroids, you know, for a week in the middle of the summer. The church camp tradition has roots in various traditions, you know, Baptist traditions and Pentecostal traditions, Methodist traditions. It was particularly in the Methodist and Wesleyan tradition that I was raised with. And so church camp was a big part of my upbringing, you know, very formative influence on me. So, yeah, I got church as a result, you know, every Sunday, every Wednesday, you know, week in the summer like that at camp. I have a brother who I think is still a little resentful that he had to go to church as much as he did. But it was very important, a very important part of the family, you know, growing up. But yeah, it was God's grace at work in her life, I'm convinced, that enabled her, you know, to get past some of those really traumatic and dysfunctional aspects of her past and of her own upbringing. And, you know, she was a work in progress, and still there were some rough edges to her personality and character right till the end, you know. That goes for all of us. But if you look at the distance that God enabled her to traverse by his grace, it's a remarkable story.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I also think, you know, we know that without God's grace, we wouldn't be able to be morally transformed. But, you know, I also think your mom's kind of a moral hero, too. I mean, to make that transition is not easy, to choose to embrace goodness instead of letting it eat you and destroy you, and then to pass it on to your children. I mean, that's pretty, I mean, because considering her background, right, I mean, no, you could easily see it, her becoming an alcoholic, and then likely you wouldn't be where you are today, or you wouldn't be who you are today, if you were raised that way. I mean, it's just interesting in a way that, like, the moral transformation of a mother can be magnified like that.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, you know. And you're so right that moral transformation requires a coming to terms, you know, with those hurtful aspects of your past and those people that you might have hurt or that might have hurt you.
Right.
And so part and parcel of the transformation process is forgiveness. You know, because, I mean, even if, you know, one's life were to become a utopia tomorrow, there are still past hurts that need to be reconciled to,
right.
to be, you know, get got past. And I think that my mom did struggle with issues of unforgiveness with respect to her own father because of the depth of the hurt there. And I do think that eventually she really was able to, by God's grace, let it go and really, truly, you know, forgive
mm-hmm.
and be able to move on. But that can only happen, and especially in cases of abuse
right.
Of this type or even worse cases, that can only happen by tapping into the resources that God makes available. You know, as much as we might like to forgive, and as much as we might choose to forgive volitionally out of our own resources, the sort of true, deep, complete forgiveness that being really hurt requires, I think anyway, is only made possible by the operation of God's grace within us, where we appropriate, you know, what Christ did on the cross and extend that forgiveness mm-hmm. that we've been forgiven to others. And sometimes that does take time, you know, because there might well have been a certain, you know, real break in the relationship, real damage that was done, you know, and forgiveness doesn't necessarily involve hanging out with that person, you know,
right.
all the day long. Sometimes if you're dealing with an abusive parent, I have had a student in class this term who shared the story with me, you know, that though he had forgiven his father for being abusive, he also chose, not to spend a lot of time with him anymore because he wasn't going to, you know, allow that damage to continue to be incurred
mm-hmm.
at even an emotional level. Right. And so we shouldn't conflate issues of forgiveness with issues of, you know, everything is just back to normal.
Right.
Right? And I mean, a wife might forgive an abusing husband. That doesn't mean that she necessarily has to stay with him.
Right.
Right? If he's continuing in that behavior. So, the you know, there could be very complicated depths to the discussion, obviously. But I really do think the evidence would suggest my mom was able, by God's grace, to get to a point of truly, deeply forgiving her father for what he did. She wasn't bitter about it or anything like that after a certain point. She would lament her upbringing. She would describe it sometimes in objective terms mm-hmm. and some of its more lamentable aspects and such. But it wasn't about bitterness. You know, she wasn't dwelling on it in that sort of way. She wasn't harboring resentment intentionally or anything like that. She just came to terms with what the truth of the situation was. And as a Christian, I think she recognized that in order for there to be the deepest healing, not only did she need to extend the forgiveness, he needed to come to terms with what he did himself and accept the forgiveness,
mm-hmm.
you know. So forgiveness itself is a very rich topic. We should talk about it sometime here on the site.
Well, you know, for a lot of people, Mother's Day is really hard because their mother wasn't there for them, or maybe they had an abusive mother. And I wonder, one thing I think about just in that is how your mom is kind of an example of how to respond to that. Maybe how to respond to a parent that maybe didn't, not just had imperfections, but really kind of let you down, you know? And maybe that's really kind of, I mean, that's not really kind of euphemistic for what happened to your mom. I mean, not just left her, let her down, but really mistreated her and abused her.
Yeah.
So what, maybe we could talk a little bit about what you could say to that person whose mother was not there for them.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe they lost a mother, mm-hmm. right? Maybe their mother was abusive. Maybe they were abandoned by a mother. Maybe they haven't been the mother that they hoped to be or aspired to be. They've made mistakes of their own, right? You're right. There could be all manner of reasons why someone, when Mother's Day comes along, could be very sad. You know, I could think about, oh, my mother, she's dead. She's gone. Yeah. So I'm sad. Now I'm depressed. And there's nothing wrong, of course, with are filled with sadness or regrets come Mother's Day or what have you. And every mother, again, like I said before, makes mistakes. Mm-hmm. And so everybody could, if they want, you know, kind of wallow in guilt and whatnot, say, for failures from the past. But I think this is where the good news of the Christian gospel has ever so much to say, right? Because it is good news for us, all of whom are sinners. You know, all of us have fallen short. And that goes for mothers who, you know, weren't the best. So, you know, Mother's Day can be celebratory if we have reason to hope, right, that sin isn't going to win, that at the end of the day, darkness isn't going to prevail over light. Even if every earthly parent falls, every earthly mother falls short, the beautiful good news of the gospel is that our heavenly parent loves us completely, absolutely completely, loves us through and through, and intends what is best for us, and wants us to experience joy eternal. And whatever it is that we might have endured in this life, whether it be abuse, abandonment, or whatever, there can be healing, there can be redemption, and those tragedies can be replaced with a sense of life as ultimate comedy and victory, you know? So if you come along Mother's Day and you are sad, you're depressed because, say, your mother abandoned you or abused you or something like that, it can still be a celebratory day in the sense of you have the hope of something better. You have the hope of the way it should have been instead, mm-hmm. and the way it ultimately will be. Because if you put your faith and trust in God, then irrespective of whatever an earthly parent might have done wrong, your heavenly parent is not going to let you down. You can reside in the palm of his hand. You can trust him to redeem the sufferings of your life, to forgive your own sins, because we all have them, to transform us, you know, into what he intends. So this sense that, you know, the upbringing wasn't what it should have been, or the parent wasn't what the parent should have been, the mother wasn't who she should have been, right? That's all fine. Mm-hmm. That's all part of the human condition. We all have those regrets. We all have those laments and recognition of objective failures and falling short, you know. But God is in the business of forgiving sin, you know, redeeming bad situations, and filling us with a hope that will not disappoint, with light that can truly overcome all of that darkness from the past. So if it's hope you want, and if it's hope you wish to celebrate, then on a Mother's Day, you can do that. If you have an earthly mother, or you had an earthly mother who really was a godly person and who raised you right and who loved you, all the better. That's great. That's wonderful. You know, but the good news is for everybody. Irrespective of your upbringing, irrespective of whatever tragedies you might have had to endure in your life, irrespective of how badly a parent might have fallen short or failed you or hurt you or whatever, right? There is more to the story to come. And there is a way in which to experience victory. And so, you know, it's the good news of the gospel all over again. And that speaks resoundingly, I think, on a day like Mother's Day.
Yeah, that's a great, you know what it reminds me of is, you know, it's like this. Maybe this is my own experience, but, we always talk about God as Father, that's who he identifies himself as, right? But I think, at least in our culture, with the idea of a father, you get the idea of, like, God being sort of maybe stern a little bit, maybe a little bit withholding, you know, to some extent. Fathers and maybe not, you know, in our culture, right? They are typically more. They're there to provide. They're there to discipline. They're there to kind of be the stoic figure, right? And if we think of God as a father like that, then I think we have trouble believing that God has affection for us, right? That God, even when we sin, that God has affection for us. The kind of love that your mother has for you is the kind of love that doesn't, I mean, at least if I think like the ideal mother, right? It's the kind of love that when you get a bad grade at school or when whatever dumb thing you did as a child that you broke the vase or whatever, that she says, daughter, that's okay, you know. All right, we'll love you anyway, but your dad's going to be mad when he gets home, kind of thing, right? I think that's something about God that it's hard to believe, right? That it's hard to believe on an emotional level, I think, that God really loves you and not just sort of stoically loves you, right? But has affection for you, like a mother has affection for her children. And like, you know, Jesus even said about Jerusalem, how he longed to gather them as a mother gathers her chicks, right? That, and for me, I think, at least from my own experience, that's hard to get your head around.
Yeah. I think it's a great idea you have here. You know, we do use God, the image of God the Father, and I think that, you know, it's biblical and it's important. And maybe on Father's Day we can talk about that. I think that there are some things about that are significant. But that doesn't mean that God is male, right? If anything, you might say, and this is anthropomorphic, but I mean, it's more accurate than saying God is male. You might say, more like male and female and more, or something like that. I mean, everything that we have, he is, but more, you know. I don't mean the sin part, but in terms of, you know, the predominant characteristics or what have you, you know. He can be very much, you know, like a father. He can be very much like a mother, right? But if you think about the love of a mother for her child, the way it ought to be, and the way it often so often is, you know, the sort of love that, you know, in a car accident, the car, you know, screeches out of control and rolls over and everything else, the kind of love that just without hesitation that mother enfolds her child in her arms, you know, to take the brunt of any you know, force and trauma, you know, gladly, willingly, without hesitation, if need be, sacrificing herself for her child. That kind of love. There's something so special about a mother's love for her child. And that special love. Now, imagine being a drop in the infinite ocean of God's love for each of us, right? Now you're beginning to understand what it means when we say that God is a God of love, you know? I mean, I really think that in microcosm, with a fleeting glance, to some, you know, inchoate degree, you can see the most loving earthly mother, in the most loving earthly mother, a picture, just a glimpse, but, you know, of God's love for us. You know, Jonathan, I've said it so many times, you know, that God is love, God is love, and then you get some people who think that, well, that just means that love, God is soft and syrupy, and he, you know, he's kind of avuncular and kind of benighted, and, you know, he just loves us unconditionally, however we are, and this sort of thing. It's just a soft sort of concept. You know, I accept you, you know, just as you are, no problem, you know. But that's not what biblical love is. Biblical love is literally hard as nails, right? It's the sort of love that means that God, for each one of us, wants what is absolutely best for us, right? He cares infinitely with such passion and depth that we can't even begin to get our minds around it, right? Desires our very best, wants what's absolutely best for us. And he knows what that is. And most ultimately, it's a loving relationship with him. And then secondarily, but closely connected with it, a loving relationship with other people. So the idea that love is just this soft, benighted, you know, kind of, you know, slightly bewildered, subjective, you know, feeling that doesn't have hard practical implications. It's not a biblical notion at all. It's some kind of, you know, weird, watered-down, domesticated idea about what love is. It's not what biblical love is. Biblical love meant Jesus was willing to go to the cross and be nailed to it for our sins and for our redemption so that we might be reconciled to God and be filled with eternal joy. A mother's love for her child doesn't mean that she's just going to say, do whatever you want. There are no guidelines. There are no parameters, you know, at all. No, that's closer to hate than love, right? Love sometimes means not being popular with your child, not just being a buddy to your child, right? Being willing to do the hard thing and say, you know what? There are some things that I'm not going to allow you to do. There are some things that you've done that merit punishment or something like that, and I'm going to do the unpopular thing here, and I'm going to draw the line, or I'm going to impose the punishment. And it's not because I don't like you, it's not because I don't love you, it's because I do love you. I love you enough to do those impositions, right? Mm-hmm. to impose those constraints and whatnot. So love has implications. We see it even at the level of earthly relationships and a mother's love for her child. But most surely, you know, God chastens those whom he loves, we're told, and such, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, a discipline from a parent, if it's done well and in the right sort of way, is further evidence of love, because love desires what is best in the beloved.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and I think that's interesting you say that, because I think that within Christian circles, maybe, we often, I think it almost goes, well, I guess it just depends when you ask, maybe, but it seems like there's also this tendency to go the other way with that and say, to reduce love to only action, right? That love is, you hear this all the time, I don't like that person, but I love them. But, we think of God as when he sent his son to die for us, that, or at least some of us do, that what that means is he doesn't really like us. But, you know, he's a good guy, so he does the loving thing, and he sent his son for us. But I think that one of the things that this facet of God's character that mothers can reveal is this, that love is both those things. It is both having affection, and it is acting for your good, right?
I think that is right. I think that's right, and that's a nice addition to what I was saying. Because although we can make that point about how, you know, love is about, you know, desiring what is best for the beloved, and so it's just rooted to the actions that you take toward that person. You know, and you can make that point, and there's a point to be made along those lines. it really needs to be augmented with something else, you know? Yeah, I think there is an affective component here, you know? If I say I love my wife, and I by that only mean that I do everything I can, you know, to make her a good person, a better person, you know, satisfied, fulfilled, and happy and joyous and all of these sorts of things. But if I truly don't have any kind of real subjective warmth mm-hmm. for her, there's something deficient, right. I think, in the relationship. You know, and now we might not have direct volitional control over those subjective, affective experiences.
Right.
I'm saying affective, not effective, right? With affective with an A. We might not have direct volitional control over some of those things, but I suspect that the way God has made us, that when we treat people as we ought, you know, when we pursue those right actions and so forth toward them, you know, that many times, at least, you know, some of those warm feelings will follow,
yeah.
right, if they're not already there. And if they are already there, they can only intensify all the more, you know, as time goes on. But yeah, I think that is a component of a full, rich, robust understanding of what love is. And yeah, I don't think we should shy away from it. I think that that's right. I think that's right. And yeah, I think that you're right that a mother's love for her child can be a beautiful illustration of that aspect, that dimension, you know, of what real love is.
Yeah. Well, here's another question for you. What makes a good mother? What is a good mother?
Your wife's about to have a baby.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. She is. Yep.
So your wife's about to become a mother. So, how would you answer that question?
Well, you know, it would have been a good idea to have a good mother here to answer that. I think.
I tried to get my wife to come, but she had too much grading to do. Well, there's undeniably, I think, something so special about a mother's, you know, love for her child, as we were discussing before. One of the things let me approach it this way, Jonathan.
Mm, yeah.
We haven't on this website, you know, taken on the hot potato of the same-sex marriage debate and all that business. But I would share a big reservation that I have about same-sex marriage. You know, if the society really decides to go in this direction, right, and puts its imprimatur on same-sex marriages, not just allowing people of the same sex to live together and that sort of thing, but to dub those relationships as marriages, you know, then overnight it's going to become, once that happens, right, in some places it already has, illegal to say to them that they're not going to be able to say to adopt children or something like that, right? Because it's a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this couple and they want to adopt and you can't discriminate against them because they're on a legal par. And there are plenty of same-sex couples already that are raising children. And some of those children, you know, would argue for the rights of their parents, you know, to do that. And others, among them, not so much. I mean, there are some kids who are raised by same-sex couples who say they'd really prefer, you know, to have had a mother and a father.
Right.
My concern is that once the idea of child rearing becomes normatively attached to either heterosexual parents or gay parents, that it's what it's essentially going to communicate to the culture is that the father or the mother is kind of eliminable, right? You could have two dads or you could have two moms,
mm-hmm.
You know, and there's no real difference, you know, between those situations and a situation where you have a mother and a father. And I really suspect that would be a mistake, because it seems to me that mothers and fathers are different, you know, and you already alluded to this a little bit before, but I think that's right. I mean, I think that men and women are different. I think we're just hardwired differently. We look at the world differently, you know. And there is a complementary nature, you know, to male and female, exactly because of these differences. And I really think that something crucial is kind of left out when a child is raised by only one parent, or by two men, or by two women. And, of course, oftentimes plenty of things are left out when a child is raised by both a mother and a father.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think we should just double down on that and say, well, then I guess it doesn't really matter. You know, one parent, three parents, two men, what have you. I mean, any combination that you want. I think there's something very special about being raised by a mother and a father. I know in my own case, it was very special. And, you know, and I know a lot of people, you know, can't point to the same sort of experience in their own childhoods that you and I can. You know, not everybody is raised by both. But I think there are tremendous advantages to being raised by both. I loved my dad. I thought he was a great man. I learned so much from him. You know, he was a hard worker. He was humble. He's just a great guy, very funny, loved God. But I tell you, and I'd love to talk about him some more on another day, maybe Father's Day.
Yeah.
But when I think about my mom, and I think about the influence that she had on me, the person I am today, largely because of her influence, and any you know, lamentable aspects of my character today are not attributable to her. those are my fault. But when I think about all of the great gifts and encouragement and love that she gave me through the years, I just can't imagine it. Can't imagine having grown up without her, having grown up without that experience. There's just something very special there, and I think I'm struggling to find the right words to articulate it, just like you were before, because, you know, it is practically inarticulable. I mean, there's something almost transcendent, there's something almost ineffable about a mother's love for her child. At least it wasn't my case, you know, and I know that a lot of people would give testament to the same sort of experience. If you just know in the depth of your soul that your mother, as you say, loves you,
mm-hmm.
you know, that she's got your back, you know that you can rely on her. I mean, that just gives you such an internal source, I think, of strength, mm-hmm. sustenance, you know, and ability to generate the wherewithal to face the challenges of life with optimism.
Yeah, let me add to that, because it's I think that's the hitting on the right note there, because what you said is true, but it's also not just that she believes in you and that she loves you. It's that there's no conceivable scenario in which that she could stop. That, you know, we have this unconditional kind of love that even if you're a total failure in your life, even if, you know, you hurt her, right? You know, we've probably all said things to our mothers growing up that we regret. But you know what? Mothers keep loving you. I mean, that kind of security and that kind of when you grow up believing that's the way the world is, that there are people out there that love you no matter what, and that are for you no matter what. Imagine the kind of difference that makes to your character. You know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's so true. And I think that the reason why a mother's love is such an intimation of the divine love, at least ideally, is because indeed such love is in microcosm a little window of insight, right? It's a picture of God's love for us, which is so very great and deep and wonderful, you know. And again, I think a lot of people have a hard time believing that God is a God of love, because they think that God is just champing at the bit to find a reason to send you to hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all of us, if we're honest, know down deep, we have all matter, you know, darkness and corruption and perversity in our heart from which we need, you know, deliverance, right? I'm always amazed when people say, yeah, I don't need God to be good. I'm already good. I'm like, really? You think you're good? I look at myself and I'm thinking, I'm not very good. I have a long way to go. If you're honest, it seems to me you realize you need forgiveness, you need transformation, and all these kinds of things. But take that honest recognition, twist it a little bit, and it becomes, oh, you know, God must really not like me at all. I mean, as dark as I am, as sinful as I am, as corrupt and perverse as I am, as many times as I've fallen short, you know, someone that I care for very deeply in my life just recently told me, and he's a Christian, but that when he hears the gospel message, you know, reiterated, and he's honest with himself, he feels like he's done too much, you know, to get God's favor. But of course, there's nothing we can do to merit God's favor, right? This is just a basic theological mistake, a fundamental one, but one that so many people make. They think somehow that their sin is greater than God's love, greater than God's forgiveness, greater than what Jesus did on the cross. Yeah. And that, sadly, I hate to say it, but it's true, is nothing but hubris on our part. We somehow think that we're bigger and better than God. I mean, however much God is filled with love, we're filled with such darkness and corruption, it's just too much for God to handle, you know? Anyway, for one reason or another, whether it's a theological mistake or a subjective sense of guilt or what have you, people doubt God's love for them at some level. And they really think that, you know, he'd relish the chance to send them to hell. He would, you know, be very gleeful about the opportunity. You know, he's just looking for an excuse. He's looking for an excuse to be justified to send that person to hell, to render them, you know, to perdition. Relegate them to perdition forever. Well, you know, it's a question of who you think God is. God is a God of unspeakable love. Yes, he's a God of justice, and he's a God of holiness, and so forth, but don't use those concepts to smuggle in concepts like, yeah, and down deep, he doesn't really even like you at all, yeah. Right? Because it's not that way. No, he really does truly love you. And in fact, if anyone goes to hell, it's not because God refuses to forgive them. He's offering them forgiveness. He's offering them forgiveness. But because they won't acknowledge their wrongdoing and they won't repent, they can't accept the forgiveness. And that's what results in their going to hell. Nobody has to go to hell. Nobody was supposed to go to hell. It wasn't intended for us as human beings. It was intended for Satan and his followers, you know, who directly in the presence of God rebelled. If any human being goes to hell, it's an utter just tragedy. It's just a tragedy, you know. Now, it's not a tragedy that's going to veto heaven, right? It's instead going to be like the petulant child who, you know, just refuses to give up his wrongdoing, you know, and gets relegated to his room, you know. But the adults are going to continue having a good time, and though they'll regret the petulant child's activities, it's not going to rob them of the joy that is theirs. God wants to forgive everyone. He extends the offer. He loves us all truly and deeply. And the best earthly mothers model that to some degree, and that's a great reminder. But ultimately, even more importantly than those earthly mothers, of ultimate importance is God's love for each one of us. Because whether we have an earthly mother or not, we all have that heavenly Father who is offering forgiveness, who is offering love, and who wants a relationship with us, and who can redeem every tragic circumstance of our lives. Anticipating her death was imminent, my mom spoke these words on September 19th, 2012. Tell the kids to serve the Lord and love each other and help each other. What more could I want as a mother? Those are my last words. They weren't her last words, as it happens, but they were certainly the words that best reflected her dying wishes. So there you have it. The indomitable, formidable, hilarious, irrepressible Evelyn Ruth Salter Baggett, the woman I was privileged to call Mom, has finished her race, and she ran well. 1930 to 2013. Let me talk a bit about the Dash. Born to German parents in Detroit, Michigan, she was one of six children. Her sister, Martha, died as a teenager in a drowning accident.
Later, she would lose two other siblings, and she was survived by a brother and a sister, Jim and Alice. As a teen, she got a job at a candy counter at Woolworth's, and she said she gave away so much free candy that later, when they went out of business, she was convinced it was her fault. She was also proud to admit that she had deep personal acquaintance with every variety of candy that they sold, perhaps helping account for her lifelong sweet tooth. Right near the end, in fact, in the hospital, before dozing into a coma, she blurted out, "I know what I want. A piece of chocolate cake. A piece of carrot cake. Coffee." My mother's mother was a gentle, loving person, and my mom adored her. Back in September, a few minutes after she spoke those dying wishes I mentioned, she talked about the last time she saw her mother alive. Her mom was in the hospital, suffering from congestive heart failure, and at the end of their visit, my mom went to kiss her, but my grandma had wires in her nose at the time and said, "I'll kiss you next time." "I didn't see her alive again," my mom reflected, and then quietly added, "I'm waiting for that kiss in heaven." Although her mother was a tender soul, her father was a violent drunk, which made, as it is wont to, her childhood less than a happy one, and made her quite the rabid teetotaler for the remainder of her days. While still a teenager, she was told by him in one of his drunken rages to get out of the house, which she did immediately, with the clothes on her back, a pocket full of bus tickets, and enough money for two phone calls, she left to fend for herself and make her way in the world. And she did. She secured an apartment over the phone on the promise of paying rent on payday, took two bus lines, and moved in. Before long, she had herself all set up and was doing fine. She assured me that she went out on some dates through this time, but nobody struck her fancy until one day she was with a co-worker who was on the phone with a friend, and that friend would turn out to be my dad. While those talked on the phone, my mom, then a fun-loving, mischievous, sneaker-wearing 20-year-old girl, which is, by the way, pretty much how I picture her now in heaven, was doing everything she could think of to crack up a friend on the phone. She was trying on football helmets and crashing into things, all sorts of crazy stuff. "I was just a stupid kid," she'd often say later. Well, she so tickled her friend on the phone with my dad that he wanted to meet this eccentric, ebullient young lady, and eventually they did, and my mom says that as soon as they met, she knew she'd marry him because he was pretty, not least because of the cute freckle on his lip. That's a direct quote from her. A few years later, a week after my dad returned from Korea, they got married. When she became pregnant for the first time, she left her billing job despite all sorts of attempts by her employer to keep her because she wanted to raise her baby, and this marked the role with which she's most identified in the minds of most anyone who knew her, a mom. And a wonderful mother she was. It was always her prayer that she would live long enough to raise her children. That eldest child was Sharon, a fast maturing and precocious nurturer and giver. While very young, Sharon stood between my parents on a drive. Two, Sharon was told, nowhere in particular. After a while, riding in the car, Sharon asked, "Daddy, when are we going to get to nowhere in particular?" My mom loved recounting that tale, and she loved Sharon. I had to tell my mom a few years ago that Sharon, at 53, after suffering from a series of maladies and afflictions, had somewhat unexpectedly died suddenly. I hadn't cried that morning when I got the news, despite its heart-wrenching nature, not until I saw my mom's reaction at the tragedy. She just writhed in excruciating pain and inconsolable grief. Sometimes I think of Mary, who stood at the foot of the cross, watching her son die, not looking away, but with him to the end, drinking to its dregs the pain only a mother could know. I saw my mom drink dregs of her own that day, and I rejoice that she and Sharon have now been reunited in Christ, all tears wiped away. I'm also relieved that she doesn't have to watch another child die. A few years later, she became a mother for a second time to my sister Sandra, a wide-eyed thing of beauty and blazing blonde hair, who grew up to be a charismatic, people-loving person. Sandra is her mother's daughter, whose own love as a mother is obvious for all to see. "Trees here, trees there, trees everywhere," a poem Sandra wrote as a child that my mom loved to repeat. Mark would be born a year to the day after Sandra, a loving son and caring spirit, always there for my mom, who loved him so very deeply, and someone who loves his mom with all his heart. Mark was the one most roped into accompanying my mom in street witnessing, including the time when a particular person started yelling, "You're crazy, lady," and kept on yelling it even after my mom and my brother Mark were far down the street. Later would come Lenny, my sweet and tender brother, and my mom's biggest companion after the death of my dad 20 years ago, after my parents celebrated their 40th anniversary in the hospital 3 weeks prior to his death. My mom loved the story of little Lenny's riding in the car when she said, and it was July at the time, "Oh, look at the snowball bush," to which Lenny said, "Uh-oh, me better go get my bootsies on." And then came Gary, the passionate and fiery redhead, and more like my mom in certain respects than either of them would care to admit. Gary was the one who always told church members the family business, even after getting in trouble for it time and again. All the punishment did was make him preface the usually mortifying revelations with, "I'm not supposed to tell you this, but..." After Gary was a miscarriage, and after that I came along. As for what my mom would say about me, suffice it to say, and this is an absolutely true story, that she came out of her coma at one point near the end just long enough to say, and to say to me three times, "Don't talk so much." I get to live with that one. Thanks, Mom. But let's be honest, it wasn't the first time she'd said it to me. I mentioned the kids, all of whom she was able to raise in answer to her prayer, because they were all the world to her. Admittedly, after a certain point, she told us all to call her Evelyn in public because she didn't want anyone to know she had kids that old. God, my dad, her kids, their kids' kids, and then all the other kids she took care of and taught Sunday school to and such through all the years. She loved deeply. She invested herself in the lives of so many. It was her faith in God, most of all, that defined her. She and my dad had both been raised in something of Christian homes, but around the time my brother Lenny was born, they both had a born-again experience and became committed churchgoers and lovers of Jesus. She taught Sunday school, she visited the shut-ins, she went house-calling, family camp every year with kids in tow. The list goes on and on. Her relationship with God was the most important thing about her, bar none, and the most important heritage she has left behind. My mom was the most generous person I know, I've ever known. She heeded biblical warnings against inordinate love of money. Money meant nothing to her. If she had it, she gave it away, storing up all manner of treasures in heaven, where she always envisioned herself with curly hair and able to sing, two traits that she always yearned for. Also, no boobs, so she wouldn't have to wear a bra, but I'll not mention that one. My mom was an encourager, everyone's biggest fan, always pushing people to do and be their best, a cheerleader. She attended my dissertation defense and told me afterwards she had no doubt I'd be able to answer the various questions. I had doubts aplenty, but she never doubted for a second. Never stopped believing in God or in us. She was spontaneous. Mention of a trip to Frankenmuth with a cottage by my dad, and they were off. She was adventurous. When Jerry Falwell died, and these beautiful flowers here from Jerry Jr. and his wife, I encouraged her to come down for the funeral, so she packed up her cats and drove to Lynchburg in one shot. She'd do the same down to Atlanta to visit Mark, or Kentucky for Sandra, or the cottage with Lenny. In the last 10 years, she and I went to England twice, where she explored the learned halls of Oxford and Cambridge like she owned the joints. At Magdalen College at Cambridge, she asked if they had a brochure in American, and the guy said, "Will one in English do?" She walked right up to Anthony Flew and gave him her best apologetic effort, not intimidated in the least. Yeah, Oxford's cool. My mom was cooler. When I lived in Michigan, and she and I went to a Wheaton conference, a philosophy conference outside Chicago, we ended up going three times. She was always a tad skeptical about philosophy because she claimed no philosopher could tell her exactly what it is. She did enjoy going to philosophy conferences, though, but it baffled her how one guy gets up to preach, and I agree with everything he says, then someone else gets up to preach and says the exact opposite of everything the first guy said, and I don't know what to believe. At any rate, the first time to Wheaton, we stopped at Notre Dame because I wanted to see the campus with its fabled golden dome and touchdown Jesus. As it happened, we arrived on the campus just as a football game was letting out, and people had begun to stream out of the stadium into the parking lots. I parked the car, went off to explore, after she assured me she was fine. A short while later, after my jaunt around the campus, I returned to the car to find her sitting there with the biggest plate of food you can imagine. "Where'd you get that?" I asked her. "Well," she said in complete innocence, "I went over there to that concession stand," pointing to a tailgate party, "and I ordered a hot dog. They didn't have one, but they gave me all this food. They were so nice. I got all my purse to pay, but they wouldn't let me, and then I said, Well, and then they said if I come back next week, they'd have a hot dog for me. And then she paused in genuine befuddlement and added, what I don't understand is how they can make it as a business if they don't charge anyone. And that, my friends, is the story of my mother crashing a tailgate party at Notre Dame. She met the needs of others. When a neighbor was dying in Michigan for years, twice a week she made food for the family, often enough for the week, and dropped it off, expecting nothing in return. She loved animals, including her most recent cat, Buffy, who was her constant companion. She rooted for the underdog, the vulnerable. She was proud of her pretty legs as an 82-year-old. She'd show them off to family and nurses and, well, pretty much anyone. Look at that leg, she'd say, hoisting it in the air. Mark told her it looked like a chicken wing, but she was undaunted and most proud. Why can't I get a man with a leg like that, she'd ask. Then she'd remember that all sorts of men had actually asked her out after my dad died, and she'd always just said no. She came to think that was a mistake. On her deathbed, she said, how stupid was that? Just think of all that free coffee I could have had. She was a prayer warrior, holding up her kids and others in intercessory prayer incessantly. She was a person of strong convictions who knew what she believed and why. She loved her church, she loved her neighbors, and she loved Michigan. Never at home in Virginia, she always wanted to go home to Michigan. Right near the end, lying unconscious, at one point she opened her eyes and with a grand gesticulation said, Michigan! Then immediately went back to sleep. She was strong. I laughed when one of the nurses saw this so well and said, I don't buy this, I'm just a little old lady routine, she's tough as nails. So many of her qualities that could drive me to exasperation, I now realize, were what most defined her, what most made her delightful and one of a kind, and the wonderful, winsome woman she was. Like when I asked her if a Christian could believe in evolution, and after a moment's thought she said, no. What about C.S. Lewis, I asked, what about him? I asked, and she said, well, what about him? And I said, well, he was a Christian, and he believed in evolution. So, she said, I'm not talking about C.S. Lewis, I'm talking about evolution. Perhaps this helps explain why I went into philosophy. She was a fighter. She was tenacious. When she was giving death a run for its money near the end, I called her a fighter, and my brother Mark, more aptly, I think, said, no, she's a lover. I suspect it was hard for her to let go, just as it was hard for us to let her go. But there's a time to be born and a time to die, and it was time for her to go home. Her real home, even better than Michigan. We're all just passing through here. Her true life has now begun. Right near the end of my dad's life, a cute thing happened. My mom loved this story, so I'll share it with you, since it's so heartwarming to think they're together again. My dad was home working in the garage, and my mom was at the big shopping center. She called him. He answered, and she said, I hear your wife is out. Yeah, she is, he said. Well, want to slip away for a little while? She'll never know. Sure, he said. A short while later, he showed up, all spiffied up in fancy clothes, and they walked the mall hand in hand, the whole time acting as if they were doing something altogether wicked. And then he finally said he'd better get home before his wife did. They kissed. He left. When she got home, he was in the garage, wearing his greasy work clothes again, and she walked on by, asking as she did, anything go on when I was gone? No, no, he said a little too insistently, and they never mentioned it again. After my dad died, she worked hard to be self-sustaining and independent. She much preferred to help others than need help herself. She hated the loss of independence resulting from the betrayal of her body, but I tried to assure her it was all okay. I read her this series of lines I wrote while next to her in the hospital as things looked bleak near the end. Stalwart of strength, you from whom his life emerged, whose own life now ebbs away, by your side his vigil keeps, mindful that these labored breaths are few remaining. He would save each one, hold it to the ear, and listen to the echoes of the past, all pushed into this moment. Under a canopy of brilliant summer sky, you taught him how to tie his shoes. You held him tight when he was hurt, and never stopped believing. Lean on him now, no need to be strong. Time for him to hold you. A few fleeting moments of more affliction, and all will be forever light. A few nights later, with me and Mary Beth there, and a sister and brother of mine having been there soon before, my mom breathed her last very peacefully. I had prayed to see an angel when she passed, and really believed I might, but alas, nothing. After a bit, we told the nurse on duty, and she came down and confirmed that my mom had gone. I thanked her for all that she had done, and then I remembered her name. Angel. Sometimes we have not because we ask not, and sometimes we ask too vaguely. So it is. All things forever light. My mom is draped with joy and attired with glory. So many of us here remain in her orbit and ever shall. The space around us has been permanently bent by her presence, despite her momentary departure. Though we mourn, we do not mourn as those without hope. I so look forward to seeing her again, to experience the joy of which the unbridled happiness of a Christmas morning with her was but the merest foretaste. Because Jesus was raised from the dead, death has lost its sting, and she too will be raised by that same power that effected the death of death, and the same power that can be at work within us even now, and we will see her again after our work is done, as she has finished hers. Where, grave, is your victory? You got nothing. Death may have won this little skirmish or appeared to, but I loved it when my mom defied the dire predictions and subjected death to ridicule. With every breath, she made a mockery of death, and what death doesn't realize is that it has lost the war. We all have a kiss waiting for us in heaven, where the sufferings of this world pale into insignificance, and mortality is put on immortality. I can't wait to see her dance and hear her sing. God does all things well.